Hi, this is The Dark Tangent. The speech you're about to listen to was originally recorded back at DEF CON 1 in 1992 at the Sands Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. Now, the Sands has since been blown up to make room for something new, but the speeches live on. All rights are reserved except for educational uses only. If you'd like more information about DEF CON, please contact us at dt@defcon.org or visit our website at www.defcon.org. Now, get ready to sit back and listen to a great speech, and I hope to see you at a future DEF CON. Woohoo!
Discussions last night and in the hallway, and from the kinds of things we got asked, there's some general topics. You can ask us anything, but there's some general topics that seem to be of real concern, hot interest to a lot of you, and some of that would be the rights and responsibilities or liabilities of bulletin board system operators. Another one that I've had a lot of questions of, and so has Ray, is on search warrants and, you know, government corporate versus private, because the rules are real different. And if you want to be paranoid, worry about corporations, not the government. And then there's the Wiretap Act, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which impacts everything you do if you're using a modem or if you're networked in another way. So I guess you can ask any questions you want, but I know those are three areas that Ray and I've gotten a lot of questions on. So who wants to start?
Well, I have one thing to say first.
Okay.
Jeff didn't invite us here to beat you up or anything. I heard some commentary that, you know, some people feel that we sort of trod heavily on people that may not share our points of view. So at least from my perspective, we're here to learn and share. So it's not as if we're expecting anybody to change their points of view necessarily, but we certainly would like to engage you in, you know, some intellectual sparring here if necessary, whatever.
We've got a question.
You mentioned what are the liabilities of the HP boards?
Okay, if you run a board, and it really isn't specific to whether you're running it on a PC or it's on some section of CompuServe or whatever, if you're the person who is organizing and configuring a particular system, and that's a key word, you configured it. If you're the operator and you set up a codes and cards section, for example, to pick a common and boring one, clearly you are anticipating, you have the mental knowledge necessary for either civil lawsuit for damages or criminal liability.
Okay, I'm talking about a complete text file, no codes, nothing like that.
Okay, text files are different, but writing about something is not criminal. Now, that gets us over into First Amendment. Well, maybe we'll start there. The First Amendment, yes, does protect freedom of speech, freedom of press. You have a constitutional right to associate, and that doesn't have to be physical, with anyone you want to. But there is no blanket, you know, no rules kind of status anywhere in the law. You cannot give yourself magic immunity by saying, hey, I got a board and a modem, I am the New York Times. Even the New York Times does not have complete freedom under the First Amendment of speech or press. Now, we're still defining in the bulletin board arena, when are you the press under the privacy rules that relate to the press, and when are you not? But some things are real clear. If the New York Times publishes kiddie porn, they're going to get busted. That's contraband. If you use, you know, those little shopping newspapers they hand out free at the grocery store? If you use the same printing press in the daytime to publish that newsletter and at night to mint currency, the Secret Service is going to come in and bust you for the illegal stuff you do that is not protected. So the basic ground rules that are pretty clear in the law are stolen property. If you steal other people's information and publish it, you may successfully be prosecuted. That could be theft of trade secrets. It could be all kinds of other crimes. If you publish contraband, you are not protected. You don't see lists of credit card numbers and codes in the New York Times because there's a statute that says they can't publish that. That's not freedom of the press. So don't assume that by calling something speech, it gives you some kind of magic immunity. Yes?
I'd like to know what the laws about jurisdictional in international. The electronic frontier is becoming really global, so I know that Holland has passed laws and things, but say you're in another European country or just anywhere in the world, and hypothetically you hack into some other system in a different country. Now, if you got caught at that, or what, I mean, what are the whose jurisdiction is that? You know, is it like the Americans if you're in the American system, or would it be the English if you're in England or in France? I mean, what kind of what's the international policing on the laws of?
Okay, I would say the international situation is much like the American federal system, where we have 50 states and then we have a federal government, all right? Internationally, for those Americans who haven't thought about this, in many countries you don't have the patchwork of many different police departments that we have. You've got a state police department, pretty much, for this kind of stuff. But let's start with the United States, because they outnumber you. Jurisdiction in the computer area is really interesting. If you are in Arizona and you commit a crime that hurts a victim in New York State could prosecute you. Arizona could prosecute you, because where's the crime happening? It's starting here and ending there. And it is possible that if you compromise a node of some sort in Texas to get from Arizona to New York, that they could prosecute you too. Here's another hacker myth. It is safer to hack across state lines. Well, maybe, in that it makes it harder for the police or the phone company or whoever to track you, but at the same time, you are increasing the number of police agencies who may want to get involved with you. So it's a trade-off. The same thing's happening internationally. In many countries, there is already computer crime legislation. Even in those countries, especially in Europe, where they don't have a specific statute, they have what they call transborder data flow laws. That would be related to some of our privacy protections. And frankly, the Europeans and Australians are light years ahead of America in privacy laws. But I guarantee you that if they do not have a computer crime per se anti-hacking law in a particular European country, if they've passed a transborder data flow law, you're in worse jeopardy there, because they make it personal criminal liability for violating those laws. And they tend to be much stricter than what you're used to in America. Many corporations, American corporations, pulled out of certain countries in Europe entirely, or pulled an operation out of there, rather than have to abide by those very strict liability rules. A typical American marketing survey, which might involve the kind of research, you know, everybody have seen those little cards the grocery store wants to give you for a discount, and then every time you use your card at the grocery store, they're keeping a list and building a database on what you buy, okay? That kind of thing, in many countries in Europe, it would be illegal for them to collect that information, or if under that particular law they can collect it, they could not transmit personal information about a particular citizen, say of Denmark or Sweden or something, over the national border. And by its nature, what you guys are doing is sharing information across boundaries. If you do that in ignorance, you may be subject to very serious penalties in another country. Now, let's go to your international example. If an American does something that is a crime under another country's laws, can they be prosecuted in the other country? Absolutely. Most countries have treaties, and they're different. They're treaties. They're contracts. Saying, what will, you know, you want some of our guys, we want some of your guys, so we'll agree, here are the rules under which we'll extradite somebody so you can prosecute them.
Where can you find information about that?
The European community, for your standpoint, the EC, the European community, has published several reports. The council has done some research, and I think they're coming out with a whole new report soon. There are about four different multi-governmental agencies in Europe that are working on model legislation, because if they go to full European community, they're going to have to kind of go to common laws that have a certain common base, and they're going to have to work out the bugs of differences between countries. Now, internationally, are you going to get extradited for one trespass? No, of course not. Let's get real. Nobody cares enough to spend that kind of money. But there is a guy in America. Remember the guy who put out the AIDS virus? If any of you remember that? It was a worldwide virus that, well, I won't go into the details, but it was one of the viruses that spread was the AIDS virus. He's actually been tried in absentia and convicted in Italy. Okay? So that's a place he better not go on vacation. Now, internationally, there is a lot more cooperation in law enforcement. And the reason is there's a need for it. We're all having problems, and the reality is there's no safe place to hack. My concern for those of you who are naive Americans who are not used to living with a multitude of other cultures, languages, and laws the way an average European kid your age would know a lot more about the rules in other countries than you do. If you do something seriously egregious enough to get the attention of the international police, I guarantee you, if you hack someplace in Spain and they're pissed enough to get you extradited, you do not have a right to an attorney. You do not have the right to remain silent. You do not have the protections of the First Amendment. That's America only.
There's also no Bill of Rights in most places.
That's right.
No rights.
That's right. So just as I urge you to leave your dope at home when you go to tour other countries, because they don't have to play by the rules you're used to. You have more protections in America in terms of the criminal law and civil liability than you have in a lot of places. They don't have our judicial system. So if you're going to pick your targets, I urge you to be real careful what countries you're screwing with, because you are not necessarily entitled to a free attorney paid for by the state, and you will not have our rules of evidence, which are pretty common between England and America, but do not hold in other places. I mean, if you're going to screw with a computer in Iran or Iraq, they are liable to beat the shit out of you until you admit that you did it. We're not supposed to beat people up. So that's the long-winded answer to that. Let's move on. Here, you pick somebody.
One follow-up question. Isn't it true that something as simple as encrypting a mail message might violate those transporter data flows?
Oh, absolutely.
So it's not just purloined codes or trying to hack somebody's system.
It's intelligence of our military. It's How would they detect that, though?
Detect what?
That you're actually...
They monitor traffic.
Let me tell you, the biggest industrial spies in the world are in other countries. A lot of it is aimed at us. Yeah, France. But
how would they tell the difference between an encrypted...
My suggestion is that you pick up a book called The Puzzle Palettes. The author is Bamford, B-A-M-F-O-R-D. It's still in print. It's the story of the NSA. I'll capsulize it for you in one brief quote. Gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail, do they?
Yeah.
Let's see if I am a PBS owner and I put in my contract that I don't want any Fed, staff, and law enforcement person to get into my PBS.
So you have a statement at the top,
yes.
No cops allowed?
Would you guys have any guys to get into
That has absolutely no legal effect. Remember when I said you guys give each other terrible legal advice? You know, prostitutes, and I'm not insulting you, all right? But prostitutes have this like magic thing that they all, and it changes every year. If they ask an undercover cop the right question, they can't bust them. Right? Wrong. You cannot give yourself immunity. Anybody here who's contributing to or editing FRAC? You've seen the stuff that's come over. FRAC is copyrighted, and everybody can read this except cops. That has absolutely no legal effect.
So I guess the fact that
if anything, it's going to look real good to a jury when you put a statement like that out.
Also, the fact that he's registered with a number of congressmen, that doesn't have any effect.
Yeah, it does. But if you're going to take advantage of the protections of copyright, then you can't rewrite the law to suit yourself. If you're going to copyright something, you give up your copyright if you give it away to the world, okay, to some extent. And
you cannot limit your copyright to the readers you want?
Yeah, you can. And that's what software publishers do when they have licensing agreements.
So what's the difference between FRAC and that?
Well, because if you, by your behavior, this kind of goes back to criminal intent, what you are doing, the rules you're setting are partly what you say, and they're also partly what you do. Now, we've got Kurt Carnell's here in the back, and since Scott Grogan's not going to be here, he was going to do a lot on copyright. Kurt's going to be the next speaker, and I'd ask you to reserve some of your civil and copyright questions for him, because I have to learn what I need to know for my job, but I'm not nearly immersed in it the way he is. You can destroy your copyright by your behavior. You cannot say, when you copyright something, the whole idea of the copyright law is in order to allow you to both publish it and share it with the world and to benefit from your work in creating whatever it is you've created, all right? But you cannot say, I'm going to interpret the copyright law to say that some people are not going to have copyright access in some art.
Who the copyright? Who do you want to copyright?
Sure, but you cannot enforce against someone a complaint. You broke my copyright. You took a copy of my thing with one hand, if at the same time you're spreading it around on the internet and letting everybody in the world download it and not pay you or not follow whatever agreements you've asked for. Now, I could theoretically say to everybody, I'll give you a copy of my last, you know, article, search warrant, picture, cartoon, whatever, and I don't want money. I want a blank formatted diskette. And that could be, that's the rules I'm saying.
But
for my license.
Basically, shareware also would have no legal right at all.
No, shareware's different. This gets real complicated. We could do 8 hours on this, and a whole room full of lawyers would disagree. But leave it for Kurt to go into the copyright parts, okay? But all I'm saying is you cannot kind of come up with some magic formula, some religious mantra or voodoo signal that is going to protect you against the world. You can't.
And to what you said about your intention, how can a magazine that is by contribution of users have an intent if you simply publish it but somebody sends you?
Because there are certain things you are not protected from publishing. The New York Times has enormous protections as defined as the press. They do not have 100% universal, everything I say or do is blanket immunity because I'm the press. And the New York Times pays a hell of a lot of money to very big, expert, expensive attorneys because being the press can still be a complicated thing to be. And they have responsibilities and liabilities that go with the privileges. A lot of the hacker community, as I said to a couple of you outside, this is the New York Times, but I don't have any of the obligations.
My question was, if it is someone publishing, if you don't have a staff which write for you, which means you don't have control over the staff and what they write, it simply has user contributed magazine, you don't have control over what they write, you simply publish it. How can the editor have an intent over what's publishing?
Well, if you're publishing contraband, you're responsible.
Well, it's not contraband.
Okay, if there's nothing illegal about what is being written and published, then there's no problem. Now, there is debate, okay? The law is an organic process. It grows like a jungle. And you cannot at any given time say this is exactly where the line is because there'll be a new fact situation tomorrow. So there's always a gray area. And when you venture into the gray area, you take risks. And that's civil liability, criminal, or just being called a toad by your entire community.
Some of the best hacks that I know are lawyers, by the way.
Everything I've seen in fact so far doesn't appear to be slanderous. It doesn't appear to be proprietary. It doesn't appear to be criminal instruction. It just seems to be straight out of the information. What you do with the information, it doesn't appear to be biased as to what you were supposed to do with it. Is it still contraband information, even though there's nothing in fact that you couldn't find anywhere else?
It depends. Everybody remember the question was on FRAC, for example, or any of the online journals. They're publishing information. They're not specifically contraband. And where is the line on that? Well, part of it is as a society we're still drawing that line. But one of the cases you're all familiar with is Craig Nydorf. Okay, that in that instance, one of the reasons the Craig Nydorf case broke down was there were disputes over what was the value of the property and was it proprietary. Now, proving that something is proprietary, enforcing your own copyright, saying it's mine and I haven't given it away, that you know I have a right to enforce my rights, that is one of the hardest things to do in the law. Trade secret and intellectual property litigation is just booming. It's what's creating computer laws because there's a huge debate on where the ground rules are and what people can and can't do. Now, on the Nydorf case, let's say that I, Gail Thackeray, keep a diary. I don't, but let's say I did. And I wrote my little, you know, day-to-day boring details of my life. That probably has no commercial value whatsoever. Nonetheless, it is mine and I own the right to it And if you steal it from me and publish it, I do have recourse against you because, and this is where the magazine publishers sometimes get in trouble, you may not publish other people's proprietary information if you have stolen it from them without their permission. Now, how you define that and how you prove it is tough. But
wasn't Bell South selling the documents for $20?
No, Bell South was not. Another phone company was selling something very similar to the document in question, and there's a real issue as to whether all of, no, not Bellcor either, it was another Baby Bell. And there's a real question as to whether the phone company that published that could have been sued by all the Baby Bells and AT&T who shared the rights to that stuff because they shouldn't have published it. So, you know, let's move on from the copyright stuff because you've got a better person to talk about it than I am.
There was one hand back here. What's this gal right here?
Yeah, I had a question regarding encryption. I'm still new to it. Excuse my ignorance. But what is the responsibility? Let's say I'm running a network with, say, three or four bulletin boards across, like, one state, and I'm running encrypted wires back to, not encrypted information back to
that was a hypothetical question.
I'm running
Okay. I will when he finishes it.
What are the responsibilities? If I'm running an encrypted information back and forth between a few nodes, what is the standard, I should say? How responsible am I for the information going across it? And is anyone going to be directly looking at it and trying to break it?
Okay. The question was, what's the responsibility if someone, say, running a network or a series of BBSs or sharing information back and forth between locations, some of it's encrypted. And what's the responsibility of the person who's either facilitating or doing that, and is anyone looking at it and trying to break it? Well, I'm a lawyer, and the lawyer's best answer is, well, that depends. Okay? You hear a lawyer saying that, you know they're telling you the truth. Encryption is not some magic silver bullet that'll kill all the vampires in your neighborhood. It may make you look more criminal, or it may simply improve your security. There, you know, we don't look at encryption as a sign of criminal activity. You encrypt different stuff. If you are knowingly, it's not whether it's encrypted or not, as to whether you're in trouble. If you are knowingly or recklessly, in whatever capacity, sysop or user, sending or sharing or publishing someone else's stolen trade secrets or things that are contraband by law, like credit cards, passwords, access devices, the Secret Service does that, kiddie pornography, those are examples of things you may not publish without taking a serious felony risk. If you do that, we don't care if it's encrypted or not. If you're breaking the law, you are putting yourself and your users in jeopardy. If it's encrypted, is it going to be harder for the police to prove the case? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, the thing that's wrong with encryption is you've got to unencrypt it to read it sometime, right?
I had one other question that's kind of based on that. I'm like, the rules of evidence, if, let's say you're running a board, you've got 18 gigs of the latest hot shit wares on the planet, and except all on your hard drive, they're all encrypted. Maybe it'll boot up when you boot up the BBS, you have to enter an encryption, decryption password that's stored, and hypothetically it's stored within the hard disk drive. So when you come in and turn the computer off, you've got 18 gigs worth of scrambled wares. What is the rule of evidence? They've got 18 gigs of crap now, and they have to prove that the files they saw on your catalog list or the files that they downloaded from your BBS is the same shit that's on that hard drive.
Let me get this right. You're betting that that address on the Beltway, Fort Meade, you're betting that those people couldn't be invited to help?
I'm betting that if you had a high enough level of encryption that used it.
Why would it mind you?
Even if they did crack it, if they cracked it, they'd have to be admitting to cracking that algorithm.
I think you missed the point. Why don't you restate that?
Yeah, the question got a little complicated as we went through. All right, let's try and break it down into smaller pieces. Start hypothetically. You've got stuff that is encrypted, and you've somehow fixed it so that if somebody doesn't go in and look at your stuff right, it's like scrambled junk, right? Remember, now I'm talking here about police government rules, and at some point, we're going to have to wrap this up and move on, but At some point, I want to talk to you about the difference between government rules and corporate, because they can do everything that it takes me paperwork to do without it and without notice to you, and you don't have constitutional protections from your employer, okay? Very many. So let's just talk for the moment. Keep this clear. This is government rules. If you do that, you've scrambled your evidence, you've got a hotkey, whatever. Remember that if the police are there looking at your system, they have had to satisfy a judge that they have probable cause to believe a crime has been committed and probable cause to believe that evidence of that crime will be found in the location they are searching. Remember that probable cause is the same standard it takes to arrest somebody. Therefore, before the police get to your house, they've got a pretty fair hunk of proof already. They're looking for more, and maybe they'll decide not to go ahead with what they have if you've destroyed all the evidence, but I guarantee you, they have a lot of evidence, so they wouldn't be at your house.
Okay, I'm sure this wasn't different. Why has the FCC taken the position that you cannot transmit encrypted packages in a packet radio?
I'm not going to get into regulation now, and also I think it would be fair to let some of the folks who haven't asked questions do that, and then we can't take all day for this panel because we've got some great speakers coming. But we will, I guess, Jeff was going to...
We've got about 8 minutes.
Okay. Jeff was going to tell you later what we're talking about doing is kind of continuing this part of it more informally tonight after, you know, all the rest. So let's get some people who haven't asked a question yet, and then we'll move on to our speakers. Yeah.
What are the legalities of viruses?
Right now, Congress... we've had hearings. Mark Rotenberg testified, several of us did, on whether or not we should have a specific virus law. As you know, Morris, who released the Morris worm, was convicted, and the appeal did not succeed. So that even without a specific malicious code law, there are a lot of statutes that apply. There are about 40 statutes that apply to government computers in various ways.
So if you came into my house today and I had,
no, because if that were the standard possession of a virus, there's a gentleman who wrote a book here who'd be I mean, he'd be in Arizona prison right now. No, possessing a virus is not... possessing a virus is not illegal. By virus, I'm not just talking virus, okay? I'm talking about all kinds of malicious code or weird code. Possessing it's not illegal. Writing it's not illegal. Studying it is not illegal. But if you want to get the attention of a lot of pissed off people who will try and convict you, shut down the internet with one. Installing it on someone else's system and taking the callous, absolutely callous, not admirable, stupid, callous, sociopathic decision that it is your right to experiment with someone else's system and to interfere with their right to compute on their own computer. That's not just antisocial, but it's criminal. And there are a lot of different ways you can be gotten for that. If nothing else, I'm looking for the right case. I'm not even so much interested in prosecuting criminally someone who does that. So we're going to sue the hell out of people. You know where some of the great law is being made in civil liberties right now? It's 80-year-old black grandmothers who take down the Ku Klux Klan with a civil lawsuit under their civil rights. Now, if you would like to spend the rest of your lives working at Circle K and putting some corporate outfits, kids through college, organize, become definable groups and conspire, and then, frankly, the most effective tactic is civil lawsuits against you. It's easier to prove, too. I have to prove much higher level than a civil lawsuit does, and Mr. Carnell will explain that to you, I'm sure.
Right. When you were talking earlier about the human link being the weakest in the security chain, what do you suggest? I mean, if it's time to go beef up someone's security and their hardware is perfect and they've got terrible personnel problems, what's the first step? Is it retraining?
It depends on the organizational culture. I have a client right now, for instance, that absolutely refuses to ask the employees to wear badges or to carry tokens or to carry cards that will allow them to operate doors with card key sort of deal. So it's strictly cultural.
Okay.
I mean,
would you go for physical security first and then electronic security second?
I think you could build a hierarchy saying that if you were strictly talking about the hardware and software, that that's where you have to start is the physical security, and then you worry about the security, the operating system, and the box itself. But the reason she's shaking her head is, what if you have Pollard or Walker? I mean, any of you have read espionage history in this country? For a very few $100,000, the KGB decimated a good portion of the encryption infrastructure in this country. So I claim that it's always the simplest, lowest level that you look at, which is the people. It's pretty banal. Pretty ugly, nasty, stupid world out there, right?
Parts of it.
The rights and responsibilities of SysOps for email. What if people are transporting illegal information, and a good assumption to read email anyway, so you should be aware of the content. What are the possibilities as far as computers being seized, because that's where the crimes are transacted, and potential problems with SysOps before?
Okay, email is one of the hottest issues. That's a real good question. I think it's where some of you in your employment capacities are going to run into problems too. Here's where we get into the Communications Privacy Act. We do not have an easy, good answer to this. Part of the reason is that the Electronic Communications Privacy Act is one of the worst abominations in legislative history. It is more entertaining to read the tax code than to figure this statute out. It was written and lobbied and destroyed and messed up by people who freely admit to this day that when they wrote laws that apply to you, they did not know what a computer bulletin board was, and yet they were writing rules for it. So accept that it's a lousy piece of trash, that there are no easy answers. All right. One of the things in a corporation, there are two categories under the Communications Privacy Act. There are the government and then everybody else. There are users, and there are people who are communication service providers, if you want to shake it around and look at it another way. The government has specific rules that say what piece of paper we've got to have, what level of proof we have to have to do certain things. In that same statute, the communication service provider, and arguably some of you as SysOps are communication providers, may do all of those things without paperwork, without court scrutiny, and without notice to anybody. Now, I would urge you, if you are serious about trying to be a responsible SysOp and you're really trying to minimize your liability and those of your users, that you follow the Justice Department's advice and that you have a banner, a logon banner on your system. Now, I will have to say, I absolutely adore your logon banners. I collect them. I take them to police departments when we have conferences, and I absolutely love your security questionnaires too. They're very funny. A good banner, which is very simple, assuming this is you really mean it, because if you don't mean it, you're just creating problems for yourself. A good banner is something that says, "Welcome to something or other system," if you mean that. Otherwise, say no trespassing. It says, you know, this is for authorized users only, if that's what you want, or it says, welcome, everybody can log on. You know, establish your rules. The key is whatever banner you pick, and it should, if you are going to read other people's email until we get this issue resolved as to whether corporate or BBS ops have the right to read everything, and the statute seems to indicate they do, then I would suggest that you say that right up front. If you give people an expectation of privacy and then you don't live up to it, you're causing lawsuits, which is what happened in certain corporations where they didn't have a banner. They kind of, by behavior or policy or stupidity, accidentally led employees to believe that maybe their email was private. Poor Ollie North clearly didn't understand email or computers because he thought delete meant it was gone. And actually they had a backup system that the government used. So, you need to tell people what the rules are. Now, when I talk to corporate managers, I say, if you want to reserve the right, and it's not true that a good SysOp doesn't read email, there are times when if you are in charge of maintaining a system or a network, you may have to read every keystroke somewhere to solve your problem. But if you want the right to do that, the safest way right now until this area is resolved is to have a banner saying the SysOp reserves the right to read everything. Now, you can say, I don't intend to, I'm too busy, I have a life, you know, but if you don't specifically reserve the right to read anything, you are raising the possibility that somebody is going to be peeved and go after you, sue you, report you, whatever. Now, there are other aspects to the Communications Privacy Act is a newer version of the wiretap law. I'm going to wind this up by giving you the bad news, and then we'll go into more detail tonight with specific questions on it. If you violate that statute, I mean, if you think you're in a world of hurt when the Secret Service Office is looking for codes, as a private citizen, now this is a statute that covers all of us, not like search warrant law that only applies to the government. This is you as a user, as a person. If you have your scanners and you're listening to 850 megahertz, you're committing a felony, and anybody who is peeved over that has the right to sue you. And if they, a private citizen, can enforce that, all right? And you're liable for criminal prosecution. You may not intercept other people's communications unless you're a party. That means anytime you're a third party, and in some states, you can't even do it then. Everybody's got to agree. Pennsylvania, California, a lot of states. Federal law, if you are a party to the communication, you can record it, you can intercept it, you can give it to anybody. If you are not a party, you're outside listening in or outside intercepting with your lineman's handset, that's not cool. And it's especially not cool for you because here's the kicker. Personal, individual, strict liability. If somebody catches you, I don't have to prosecute you. Every person whose phone call you heard or whose email you read when you didn't have a right to has a right under the statute to sue you, and if they can't prove what their financial loss is, the statute very kindly gives them a minimum collection amount they can automatically get from you.
Of what?
It depends on what the offense is, but let me tell you, it's in the five figures in a lot of places.
Okay, going back here, I mean, but it's a small thing. Even though we've been like surrounded by these frequencies, which are plain, and if you have a scanner, anybody can hear. And then again, we have the FCC not letting you, if you have a packet radio, not to encrypt your own data, which that way nobody will be able to read it, and you will erase that problem at all.
You may not use the ham bands, which are allocated specifically for shared, open, everybody gets to listen, no privacy exchanges for packets. That is a violation of the ham rules. Now, you don't have to use those frequencies. We're working out the bugs in everybody wanting more bandwidth than there is in the airwaves, all right? But at least, without getting into all of these technical stuff, for the benefit of the math here and the common denominator problem, if you want to reserve the right to do anything that you need to control your system for your own sake, put a banner up that says, the SysOp reserves the right to read everything. It is not some magic formula to put the next line, as so many of you do, this is for information purposes only. That is not automatic legal immunity. I had one idiot in Arizona who was interviewed tell me that the long list of credit card and codes information, he said, oh, I just collect those. Well, what do you collect them for, since they just happen to be the exact configuration and length of an American Express card? Information, he said, knowledge. No, I don't think so, okay? Your behavior is going to decide what your intent was. If you're a SysOp, put a banner up saying what the rules are, and then live by them yourself, because if you give people an expectation you don't live by, you are raising a problem for yourself. So make whatever rules you want for your board, but tell people what they are.
As a parenthetical finish to my answer to Jeff's earlier question, for a large time-sharing system, for instance, the way you start is by having each user sign an agreement that says, I understand, here's the rules under which the system should be used. I understand that the data and the system is not mine. I believe this is yet to be tested in the court.
You control access to your system, do you not? You pick that level of accountability that satisfies you.
At the University of Arizona, for instance, their status quo currently is to provide you with a password which is randomly generated. You log on. If you type Y for yes, that you've read the screen, that's what they're using. That's correct. It has not been tested in court. It's worse than you can possibly imagine. Let me give you another little piece of the turf here. We have a thing called privacy-enhanced mail. Anybody familiar with the developing internet standard? In order, that's called, what you're asking is authentication, right? That's the name.
Yeah.
The name for this is authentication.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do authentication, what you have to do is walk a certification hierarchy. At the top of the certification hierarchy, you essentially just have people in large corporate organizations that are signing documents, shaking hands with one another.
You can authenticate your signature with PGP, and you don't need no.
We could discuss that ad infinitum. The point is, if you chase this long enough.
Okay.
Thank you.